From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Our next guest is Gemma Tarlock, senior editor of Discover Magazine, whose September-October cover story is titled "The Science of Gun Violence." For every death due to firearms, the U.S. spends about $63 on firearm research. In contrast, research spending on motor vehicle deaths is about $1,000 per fatality. Since publicly funding the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, traffic accidents are down dramatically, and yet there has been almost no publicly funded research on firearm injuries. Is it time for a more scientific approach to understanding this problem? Well, our next guest will help us understand the possibilities. Gemma, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for so much for having me on.
Well, as we know, it's a very, very touchy conversation, but it really shouldn't be. If we can keep politics out of it, as we're going to do in the next 20 minutes, then we can look at this crisis as a public health crisis. How do we do that more effectively?
Well, I think to back up just a little bit and explain why this story is in our magazine. We are, of course, a science magazine, and this is a science story. But, you know, the genesis of this story, it's actually an idea that I had as I think, like everyone listening right now, you've probably seen one of these mass shooting incidents. They're horrible. They're tragic. And then you watch your social media feed blow up with people arguing back and forth on all different sides. And for me, I was seeing a lot of my friends, every time there was an incident like this, a lot of my friends were citing a study about this, a study about that, you know, a meme that had a specific stat in it. And my bread and butter is data. That's what I do all day. I read the studies. I talk to the researchers about their data. So I started to think, well, okay, I want to, you know, verify some of these stats that are getting thrown around. And I found out a lot of them I couldn't verify. I just couldn't find them in the actual scientific literature. And others, when you dug a little deeper, it turns out it was a small study funded by an advocacy group that had a very particular bias towards getting a particular result in the research, which is a huge red flag. So I started digging deeper and deeper. Where is the objective, evidence-based scientific information about gun violence? And I realized there's not a lot out there, and it's really hard to find. So I developed a story with a writer that I've worked with frequently in the past, because I know he loves to go digging. So he and I said, okay, let's think about this in terms of data, in terms of what the data can tell us, the data we need to better understand the problem, and let's talk to the scientists who are trying to grapple with a problem that, you know, it's a little like trying to catch a black cat in a room without the lights on. You don't know what the problem is. You can't get your hands around it because you don't have the data to support it. So I think that's very important to understand that is how this story ended up in our magazine.
That you make an excellent point. And you, as a scientist, know how to look at a certain bit of research to qualify it as, you know, peer-reviewed or having credibility, or, as you say, was it this just a tiny study? How can we as consumers, as citizens, as people concerned about this public health crisis, look at information coming across our social media feed and do what you did? What are the steps we can take that you probably go back to your friends who say these studies and say, listen, you got to do this? What are those things?
Well, wow, that is a huge and complicated question. And, you know, I'm not a scientist. I am a science journalist. So I go into the data and into these studies as a journalist in terms of I'm looking for conflict of interest. I'm looking for what else is out there on this topic, who's challenging it, who's agreeing with it. And so looking at the data from a more journalistic perspective, and the researchers are looking at it from a more scientific perspective, if that makes sense. And, you know, in terms of the average person, it is really hard. I mean, I couldn't find the answers as a science journalist. I couldn't find the answers that I wanted to. So I would say the key thing, the thing that I think gets lost over and over in discussions about gun violence, it is very easy. It is our nature. It is in our species to react to these kinds of incidents emotionally. And also really to fall back into our existing worldview and our existing biases. So, for example, you know, I have friends who feel very strongly about gun control, and their response is very emotional and along gun control lines. I have friends who feel very strongly about gun rights. Their response is also very emotional and along gun rights lines. And I'm always trying to thread, you know, that middle space and just look at things objectively. And I think that's what we need to do. These mass shootings are horrible. Every death from gun violence is tragic. That's not up for debate. At the same time, we need to understand that these mass shootings are the tip of the gun violence iceberg in the United States. You know, 60% of people who died by firearm in 2017, it was a suicide. So we need to really objectively look at the information. And whenever you hear a stat, whenever you see, you know, a meme shared, there's always that response that's either going to be, yeah, that's what I thought, or, hey, that's wrong, they're dumb, you know. We react along those lines. But I think you want to look at that stat, you want to say, okay, how is it worded, what are they trying to say? Try and dig up the information and, of course, turn to, you know, credible sources. And I'd like to think we're a credible source, but, you know, there are other sources out there as well that can help people navigate this pretty difficult terrain.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Gemma Tarlock. She is senior editor for Discover Magazine, and we're talking about the science of guns. Gemma, you mentioned suicides. Of the 39,773 people, Americans, that lost their lives to firearms in 2017, 60%, and the number is 23,854 people, took their own lives with a gun. And the average American firearm suicide, according to your magazine article, is a married white male over 50 with physical issues. I wanted to ask you about this. A couple of policy decisions were made, and they had unintended consequences. They had nothing to do with suicide. One of those was in Switzerland. One of those was in Israel. Can you talk about those?
Sure. And again, I think it's very important when we're talking about, say, a study of young service people in Israel, which is what the study you're mentioning is. I think it's very important that we look at that in the proper context and that we not immediately extrapolate it to, say, the older American white male who's,
right,
you know, the most likely demographic to take their lives by firearm. But that said, you know, there have been studies in other countries like the two that you've mentioned. And, for example, in Israel, a few years ago, they implemented a new policy change where if you were on weekend leave, leaving the base to spend the weekend at home, you had to leave your service weapon on the base. And when they did that, they found that there was a 40% annual drop in the number of suicides by 18 to 21-year-old soldiers. And when they looked a little closer at the data, they found that this reduction, this 40% fall, came almost exclusively from a fall in weekend suicides rather than during the week. So there appeared to be correlation between having people leave their service weapons on base and a drop in weekend suicides. So, you know, there are a lot of small studies like that that may or may not be applicable to a different population, a different demographic, different age group, different life circumstances. But they are the kinds of breadcrumbs, if I can call them that, that researchers are following, because we in the United States just don't have any comparable research to really better understand the problem of suicide by firearm.
Yeah, exactly. And I believe also in your article, in the early 2000s, Swiss Army reforms, it had nothing to do with suicide, it's just that they reformed and had some new policies, have the number of soldiers they cut back on their military, which reduced the number of firearms kept in homes. And before the reduction, the suicide rate among 18 to 43-year-old men had already been falling, but they observed a very significant rate dip after that policy, just by, again, having less access to firearms.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. Mm-hmm.
So I just find it interesting that it's almost anecdotal data. It's not really a large study, but we start to see these little snippets that tell us that data can help us. Science will not have all the answers, but science can play a significant role here in policy. So it's actually encouraging.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the key thing is to think about gun violence as a public health crisis, because it really is. And, you know, the thing I keep going back to, and I kept going back to as Russ and I were developing this story, really, I can remember growing up as a little kid in the New York area, and all of a sudden there was this disease that people were whispering about, this thing called GRID. It was called, you know, gay-related immunodeficiency. What was that about? And people were dying. And it was horrible. There was a lot of emotional reaction to it, completely understandable. People were dying really horrible deaths, and no one knew why. There was also a lot of political resistance towards real scientific study of it and properly funding scientific study. And then what happened in the years that followed what we now know as HIV and AIDS? Well, what happened was scientists got the funding they needed, and they started studying the problem as a public health crisis. And they figured out what was causing it. They started to figure out transmission. Then they started to figure out ways of addressing it to either treat people who were infected or stop infection in its tracks. So this thing takes time. You know, it's not an overnight solution, but it doesn't really kick off and get going in advance until you've got the data, until you have the evidence-based science where you can look at something, setting aside the emotions, look at something objectively and say, okay, here's what we think might work. And you know what? The other thing to keep in mind, science is not a straight line. I'm sure your listeners know that. But the progress of science is a zigzag. You know, sometimes you develop a hypothesis and you design an experiment to test it. And guess what? Turns out your hypothesis was flawed. So you have to go back and revise and observe and then develop a new hypothesis. So I think, you know, we all want that quick fix. We all want gun violence to stop. But we need to look at it as scientists. And that is observe, develop a hypothesis, test it, and be ready to start from ground zero again if you need to.
And Jim, I just wanted to add quickly that before you get the data, you need the money. So if we spend $63 for every gun death, according to your article, $182,668 was spent on research per HIV death. So you need the money, and then the data comes, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, you know, what's really holding a lot of this research back, is that there's just no funding for it.
So what is the outlook for funding?
Well, you know, that remains a question mark. And there have been a few very promising initiatives. For example, Kaiser Permanente announced last year they're going to put $2 million towards specifically studying gun violence. You have other folks at University of California, Davis, at RAND, at Harvard, who are working on developing these particular studies, on designing them and testing them. And you know, there are a few very promising studies out there underway. There's one, I believe it's kicking off in California, that is going to look at gun violence in terms of if a current firearm owner from a crime they've committed is prohibited from possessing a firearm, is there a difference in the risk of a violent incident based on how quickly the firearm is taken away from that individual? And that is a study that is going to look at a very complex issue about, you know, should people with firearms have them based on their behavior and crimes they've committed? But that's going to take years to get the data together and to make sense of it. So projects are underway, but, you know, funding remains the big stumbling block.
Mm. So this might be a little bit of a mental health question versus a question that you can answer with data, and that is my question. If we look at suicide and bringing it home to the United States, if there is a suicide attempt, 13% of the time it will succeed, except if a firearm is used, then 90% of the time a suicide attempt will be successful. That is a very stark reality. And
yes,
we know that, and here's my question, it's surrounding suicide as sort of a crime of passion, for lack of a better word, something decided at the in an instant. And if you have access to a firearm, it's easier to act on it versus if you can't get to a firearm, you think about it and it passes, the desire passes. Have you seen any research on that?
Well, you know, I think to my knowledge, public health researchers do agree that suicide is typically an impulsive act. It is that, you know, that moment of despair, that moment of, you know, inner turmoil, that, and it's an impulse. And people who survive a suicide attempt very, very rarely make a second attempt. And I think that's an important thing to consider. And so from the data that's available, you know, if you use a firearm to attempt suicide, you are, as you noted, much more likely to complete the suicide. And so I think that gets back to the studies that we talked about in both Israel and Switzerland and the fall in suicide rates there that seem to support the idea that, you know, firearms are what makes suicides much more likely to be completed. In terms of more specific data around that issue, you know, the studies are very limited, again, because of the limited amount of research. As we note in the article, there was a study saying, hey, it looks like 13% of all suicide attempts are completed. That study, it's a few years old, and it was only looking at, I believe, 7 states in northeastern United States because that was all they had the funding for, basically, to design their study. So, again, we need more data. We need more research that's looking at this broader issue of gun violence, whether it's by suicide or homicide.
Yeah. And just to mention, and this is an anecdotal story, but sometimes those anecdotes can translate into bigger studies that provide research in a local high school in the Salt Lake Valley. In one, like, 3-month period, they had this rash of teenage suicides, and they were all from guns, and they were all because those teenagers had broken into a family member's gun cabinet to get the guns. So these sorts of things, you know, you say there has to be a correlation there, but, and to get a bigger study is very often very difficult.
Yeah, and you know, some of the folks looking at this issue, for example, the folks at RAND, there's a team specifically looking at gun violence in the United States, and our writer, Russ Juskalian, spoke with them at length. And one of the things they point out is, you know, there are a lot of people who say, let's just put this law in, it'll fix things, let's do this, let's do that. But we don't have the data in a lot of cases to really understand how these laws might improve or actually make something worse in terms of gun violence. We just don't have the data to say whether they would be effective or not. And one of those issues, for example, is child access prevention laws, the child safe locks and such, regarding firearms. There is good data. The RAND group found that there is good data, evidence-based research, that says, yes, child access prevention laws save children's lives. However, no one has looked at whether these same laws affect, for example, a potential suicide by firearm by an adult in that same household. No one has studied that. Yeah. So the research we have that is robust and evidence-based and something you could really hold up and say, okay, here's the science, it's typically very narrow and very limited in scope. So, again, more research, broader, more carefully designed experiments and studies, that's what's going to make things clearer for all of us.
Discover Magazine's senior editor Gemma Tarlock is our guest, and it's the September-October cover story of Discover Magazine, The Science of Gun Violence. And we thank you so much, Gemma, for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.